This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. This week, the Tennessee Valley Authority published its first ever sustainability report to provide a clearer, more accessible picture about its day-to-day operations for 10 million residents here in the Southeast, including as a leader in carbon reduction among utilities in the region. Rebecca Tolin is Vice President for Environment at TVA.
Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks, Ray. It's great to be here today.
Tell us more about this sustainability report. What is it? Why now?
We do some other federal reporting and things like that, but it's kind of not made for your listeners to digest, right? And what we've done here is put information about how TVA impacts the quality of life in this region into one report. And so we lined that up. I'll tell you where it came from, really. We were working with some economic development potential customers who wanted to come into the Valley, the Amazon and the Googles, and they were asking these questions. How do you serve the Valley? Because we want to locate and bring jobs to a place that does that, right? And so we found ourselves pulling together this information for them, and you look at it and you go, well, we need to put this out there in a way that folks can digest and interact with us on it. So that led to our first report, which we're going to keep working on it, right? It's the first one, but we're very proud of the product and the conversation that we're hoping it can create in the Valley.
And what are some things in that report that even people here in the Valley may not know because you've taken this new step in making that information more accessible to anybody who views it?
The report has information in it on how we interact with people on our public lands and our lakes and our reservoirs and the projects that we do out there. You know, we taught 10,000 kids in natural resource education last year. It also goes deep into our energy production, right? We're really working hard to make new innovations and new strides to continue to reduce carbon, but maintain that energy affordability. You can read about our reliability in there. We're 99.999% reliable. I know that's a lot of nines, but our people are really proud of it, right? And so you can read about that and the work it takes to do that. You can read about how we also try to make TVA a great place to work. We are top in safety among utilities. We really work hard to make sure our employees go home to their families like they came to us that day. It's just the breadth of information in there that I think may surprise folks, and how we work in things like economic development to bring in jobs, all the way to our nuclear facilities and the work they're doing every day, keep that baseline power on. So I think, Ray, one of the things just about the report is the breadth of it. And as folks just take a chance to look through it and say, oh, I did not know these were all these things that TVA did to serve. And so hopefully they'll take a look and get that out of it.
How do you and your colleagues see this report as a more effective mirror to yourselves and your colleagues at TVA of everything that the authority is doing?
I wanted to avoid it just being a, quote, fluff piece, right? You could do a report where you only talk about all these great things you do. Everything we do has a benefit and an impact. And so we're very much, in the report, you'll see we have metrics and we use some global standards to report on our work, right? So one of the things we're hoping is that we can talk to the Valley, who are our partners in all of this, about what we want to do moving forward. So it's a baseline for us to look at ourselves and say, what are our goals in these spaces? But it's also a tool to kind of talk to folks and say, what are your goals and how do we as TVA help you get there?
Beyond the baseline, you also acknowledge trends. Talk more about the trends that you acknowledge in that report and where TVA may be headed in response to those trends in the coming years, especially as TVA will be closing in on the century mark, not too many years into the future.
That's right. That's very true. And so, you know, I was talking to a colleague the other day and they said, well, you were the original clean energy, right? Because you originally started with just hydropower. And I think we've had this long history of these giant machines to deliver electricity. And now we are on the precipice of great change, right? The electricity industry is changing. And TVA is kind of excited and well-positioned to be that innovator in this space. So One of the biggest trends, of course, and one of the things we're working hardest on is our carbon emissions. So I know most of your listeners have probably heard these numbers before, but we are headed towards 60% reduction in 15 years in our carbon emissions, right? We are really ahead of the region in reducing those carbon emissions, but that continues to be a place where we're also doing some innovation work. You know, we're looking at small modular reactors. Near Chattanooga, we're developing a new system operation center, right? So when you start going from those big machines to these, I think we have over 4,000 sites that we get renewable energy from, you have to be able to manage that on a really complicated grid system, right? And so we're really in a leadership position in pushing that technology forward. And so I think you see a lot of excitement amongst TVA employees on what that future holds and where we're headed. I think a report like this helps us talk about that and helps us talk to the Valley about, is this where we all want to go? And so we're looking forward to having that dialogue as we go out around the Valley, talking about the report and listening to what people have to say about it.
As you say, the electricity business is changing yet again. That includes going forward how TVA will operate, and who it will partner with, and who will want to partner with TVA, as we've seen in headlines over the past few months and over the past few years.
Again, I'll go back. It's just an interesting time to be in the utility market. And one of the things we've done recently is our local power companies that are our you know, at the hip partners, they're starting to do their own renewable energy projects. And how do we incorporate that into our system and make sure we maintain reliability and affordability? And there's going to be other new technologies, other new partners to work with. And our job is to be open to those things and to make sure we're doing what's best for the Valley. You know, we're not a profit utility, so we're not running after balance sheets, right? We're really trying to invest in the Valley to make it a much better place to be. And so I think we've done that historically, and we're excited about this next chapter about how we're going to get to do that some more.
And you talked about having conversations with people out in the Valley about this report. Tell us more about those conversations and where people can go online to look at it all.
We have a website, tva.com/sustainability report, and you can see the report there. But for your listeners, there's also a place there where you can sign up with your email if you're interested in this continuing this dialogue with us. So we'll be moving around the Valley. COVID has put that on a little bit of a, made that a little bit more difficult. But we'll be moving around the Valley and talking to different groups and people. But any individual who's interested in the topic and wants to learn more, you know, we may send out updates or ask for some survey information from them on what they are driving for and what they are interested in. So we're really looking forward to that. And I think as we move around the Valley and learn more, different communities have different needs, right? And so it'll be interesting to hear where people are focused and what they expect of TVA moving forward.
All right. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Twice a week online, the Bessie Smith Cultural Center here in Chattanooga features community members reading children's books to spur dialogue on race relations. The digital series is called Bessie's Front Porch, and yesterday, Kathy Grant Willis read Coretta Scott. Here's part of that reading.
Coretta Scott by Intasaki Shange and Kadir paintings by Kadir Nelson. Some southern mornings, the moon sits like an orange sliver by the treetops. Coretta and her siblings walked all 5 miles to the nearest colored school in the darkness with the dew dampening their feet. White school bus left a funnel of dust on their faces, but songs and birds of all colors in rich soil where slaves sought freedom steadied them in the face of danger. Over years, learning and freedom took hold of Coretta's soul, till she knew in her being that the good Lord intended freedom for the Negro. Martin Luther King Jr., a young preacher, prayed for freedom. Coretta prayed, two minds attracted in prayer. Yes, they could do something among the many who thought moral power would overturn Jim Crow. They prayed together, found joy, and were married. According to Gandhi, the humility of millions could free more than just one person. It could free the world. And the world for Coretta and Martin was their South. And they went to Montgomery to their new...
Watch the entire readings from Bessie's Front Porch on the Facebook page and YouTube channel for the Bessie Smith Cultural Center. New readings appear online at 11 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. On Talking Writing this afternoon, the second part of my conversation with the journalist and historian Colin Woodard, whose most recent book, Union, looks at the roots of the current culture wars that are so fiercely dividing the country. His previous book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America, argued that the United States is actually a loose and rather contentious confederation of 11 separate nation states. In his new book, beginning with that contention, he goes on to make a case for the inevitability of our current social and political divisions.
The Civil War illustrates the complexities and dynamics. If you look at the days and months leading up to the Civil War, it was not at all clear that much of what we now consider the South was going to join in secession. Virginia at the time, that's controlled by the Tidewater gentry, who are a very different group and cultural milieu than the Deep South we've described, it wasn't clear at all that they were enthusiastic to secede in order to protect the slave system, which the Deep Southerners absolutely were. And it was also unclear what Maryland would do, which was split between these regional cultures, and so on. In fact, the best guess of many observers was that the country would peacefully fracture into three or more confederations, with, you know, sort of middle states, a northern one and a southern one, and that the mayor of New York City, Fernando Wood, actually proposed at the time that when that happened, that New York City itself and its environs secede and form a separate Hanseatic-style city-state, and that it would trade on its own and not be dominated by the awful Yankee New Englanders who controlled much of the upstate. So that was the assumption. It was the miscalculation of the South Carolinians in firing on federal forts that rallied many who would not have backed an armed suppression of the Deep Southern secession, who led them to defend the American flag and the sort of, you know, federal troops in joining the effort to stop them. So even then, what we consider the South was still divided, right? The Maryland, of course, didn't secede. Kentucky didn't. In fact, much of what I call Greater Appalachia, and these regions do not follow state boundaries. The settlement drives often cut right through states. And the Greater Appalachia was essentially on the Union side. That's where the state of West Virginia comes from. It broke off from the rest of Virginia to stay in the Union. That's why Kentucky didn't join the rebellion. That's why there was an enormous rebellion that had to be repressed by the Confederates in eastern Tennessee. In the northern part of Appalachia, the Appalachian part of Alabama, the state of Winston, same thing. In fact, there were huge numbers of Union troops recruited from units in Appalachian-dominated states who served on the Union side in places like Tennessee and the like. So that sort of illustrates the complexity of it. Appalachia didn't join Dixie, as you might say, until the Reconstruction period. During the Civil War, it was on the Union side. So, yeah, these things start, a lot of things start making a lot more sense once you realize the deep cultural fissures underneath the map and underneath our history.
Agreed. At the same time, and, you know, this may reflect the limitations of my thinking, but it seems to me that while, and perhaps I think it may still be true, that on the one hand, most people in this country embrace the idealism enshrined in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. But, oh, wait a minute. No, that's going to affect my pocketbook. I'm not sure I can do that now. And it seems to me that that's ultimately what it always boils down to. It's an economic argument.
Well, human nature is definitely subject to the temptations of personal and material advantage. That's one of the great conundrums of democratic political philosophy going way back, and affects all sorts of countries. So. Absolutely true. And, especially true in a country that was rapidly growing and industrializing, that had huge amounts of land that, you know, being expropriated from the native inhabitants was available for colonization, that people were able to, you know, do and build things and create new cities overnight. I mean, that was a very, you know, consumptive and rapidly expanding environment. It hasn't happened all that many times in history that you had something occurring that quickly. You know, it's, I guess the closest example might be China in the past 25 years, even though in a very different historical context. So in that context of rapid development, sure, all kinds of, you know, hypocrisies and tensions, but I don't think that that's particular to the United States and its component cultures. It's just the circumstances in the United States while this country was in its, you know, childhood and adolescence were such that those factors could be greatly emphasized, because everything on an economic and material front was incredibly dynamic and changing constantly.
Yes, and I certainly didn't mean to characterize it as uniquely American in any sense. The most interesting thing, and perhaps this isn't uniquely American either, the most interesting thing to me is that we seemed, and having read your book, perhaps more convinced of it, that we seem to swing from embrace of the ideal to almost the obverse of that, where the political argument seems to be almost entirely founded in an economic one. And then it comes down to, well, actually, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure where the beliefs of somebody like Woodrow Wilson, whose beliefs, sadly, I think many would agree, are echoed today in the government today. I'm not sure exactly where those ideas come from and why the thinking is that one segment of the population has such a profound influence on the fortunes of the country as a whole. I don't, because clearly they don't.
Well, I mean, one of the story of union, the story told to these people, is a struggle between this vision we've been talking about so far, that Bancroft first packaged, but mm-hmm. the vision tying the Declaration of Independence, that what defines the United States is not a shared past, but a fealty to a set of ideals, the ones we talked about in the Declaration.
Right.
That was immediately encountered almost as soon as he published it and started arguing for it in the 1830s by a counter vision coming out of the Deep South and led by a group of thinkers around the South Carolinian novelist William Gilmore Sims, the leading man of letters of the antebellum South and of the Confederacy later, who argued, you know, explicitly and strenuously that Jefferson was wrong when he wrote those words, that humans are clearly not inherently equal, that there's an entire hierarchy of humans, that some of which are capable of self-government and others clearly are not, and that the Anglo-Saxon race are the ones who devised self-government, and they're the ones with the unique genius and ability to actually live as Republican citizens, and that others who don't have these characteristics and are lacking need to be under their tutelage or indeed enslaved by them, and that the model of American republicanism, small r, is a classical republic model of that of ancient Greece and Rome, which were slave states, where a small minority had the privilege of practicing democracy and servitude and slavery was the norm for others. This was the other vision, an ethnic vision, that Sims essentially said, we are the United States is the homeland, or more correctly, homelands of the, you know, allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race. And then that's full stop. And what brings us all together is that we share in that heritage, and together as the organic nations of South Carolina and Massachusetts and so on, that's how we will achieve our destiny with no apologies. So that ethno-nationalist tradition about inequality and hierarchy and only certain people are real Americans was echoed through in the course of the book to Woodrow Wilson, who's one of my primary characters and who carries that vision to fruition in the White House and is, perhaps not surprisingly, raised in the Deep South, in Augusta, Georgia, during the Civil War, and then in his adolescence in the aftermath of the war in the burned out ruins of the South Carolinian capital, Columbia, son of the leading light of the Presbyterian Church of the Confederacy, a man who had written a sermon that was published and kind of a greatest hit in the antebellum South, arguing that God ordained slavery, and everyone thought that was great. This was the world that Woodrow Wilson came from, and the idea set that he carried with him in his histories that he wrote, in his academic work, and in his policies and behavior in the White House, and even at the peace conference in Paris. So, and what I'm saying is that this other tradition, this uglier one, about essentially white supremacy, as Anglo-Saxon became expansive to include more and more Protestants and Germans and eventually Catholics, but always excluding someone, that tradition goes back as far as the civic national tradition, is the one about ideals, as horrible it is to contemplate. And it's the white supremacist tradition that first gained consensus across the Federation and a national, quote, sense in the 1910s and 1920s under Woodrow Wilson, which is when the book closes. And the Union tells the story of that, that arc. And of course, that tradition would later be vanquished in the 1960s in favor of the ideals in the Declaration. But that battle is not over yet, as we've seen in recent years. And as you've pointed out, I think the civic national tradition is the only one that can hold this Federation together. The other one is beyond its immorality, is also a practical impossibility today, given the demographic structure of our country. So it's only a route to, you know, to ruin and civil strife, in addition to being a betrayal of the American experiment in capitals that is the elements of the United States that I think most of us treasure most when we think of American ideals and, you know, what might be good things to think about as Americans and as what we've tried to accomplish as a nation.
But if one were to look at Sims's argument and by extension Woodrow Wilson's, it boils down to an economic argument. They had in the South, as was true, come to that, in the UK after the Second World War, they had a chronic labor shortage. They had to do something. The agrarian economy with cotton or sugar in Barbados was labor intensive. They had to have a huge pool of people to work these farms, so they imported them. And then they're stuck with, well, now what do we do? Because these people don't look like us and they don't think like we do because they're from a different culture. And so they invent this whole notion of Anglo-Saxon superiority so that they can lord it over these poor souls who had nothing more than the misfortune to be kidnapped and dragged into a country they never wanted to come to in the first place.
I mean, it's certainly one of the things it achieved was those things in the economic sphere, absolutely. But, you know, some of the people articulating this Anglo-Saxon supremacy argument, you know, after the fact, usually many decades or a century or more after actual colonization had taken place, you know, may have truly believed in the inherent superiority of the group they happened to be members of. I mean, this whole Anglo-Saxon supremacy thing, you know, existed in all the regions of the country. It had many advocates, and after the failure of Reconstruction, and certainly by the time you get to the Wilson administration, you have, you know, fierce advocates of that everywhere. Even, you know, George Bancroft, in his civic myth, talking about the, you know, being devoted to ideals, he still believed that the Anglo-Saxons had been the sort of shock troops of freedom and democracy in the world, and that they'd sort of led the way. His interpretation was theoretically open to anybody who wanted to share these ideals. I mean, theoretically, like Jefferson, Bancroft did not do a lot of these things in practice or behave this way, but theoretically, that was what his vision, you know, and Jefferson's vision theoretically said, even though Jefferson was in fact a slaveholder before and after he wrote those things, and Bancroft was not by any means particularly a liberal person in terms of race relations and recognizing the inherent humanity of, you know, even such an incredible figure as Frederick Douglass, who was a contemporary of his and whose existence he managed to pointedly ignore throughout his life.
Well, I love the inclusion of Frederick Douglass's bio and narrative within the thread of your story, because he serves as a wonderful counterpoint to all of these arguments. An intelligent, articulate man who embodies the contradiction of everything they are trying to argue as white supremacists.
Right, he's a living refutation of their argument that somehow people of African descent are incapable of being, yeah. Intelligent, Republican people. Right, he escapes from slavery, and he emerges as this unbelievable orator and speaker, and becomes a superstar. He's discovered as he escapes from slavery in Maryland. He's discovered as a day laborer in New Bedford, Massachusetts, by the abolitionists, by the Garrisonians. They realize he has an incredible first-person story to tell about what slavery is actually like, and that he can tell it incredibly well. So they take him and put him on their speaker circuit, and he quickly eclipses all of them and becomes this superstar. And what's important about him is he unrelentingly, through his life, fought for those ideals in that, what I call that civic national tradition, the ones in the Declaration of Independence, the ones that Bancroft's books said were what our country was about. But Bancroft just assumed that because, supposedly God had ordained the United States was going to do these things, that we just had to complacently sit back and God's plan would unfold and nothing would shake him from the idea that America was just chosen to further freedom. Not the Civil War, not the failure of Reconstruction under the terrorist campaign of the KKK, nothing would change him. Whereas Frederick Douglass knew, of course, firsthand about the hypocrisy between what the United States declared its ideals were and what they actually were, and continually basically prodded, pointed, cajoled, shamed America into trying to achieve those ideals. These were aspirational ideals and great ones that we had not yet actually fought for and that we should. And he had perhaps misplaced faith on essentially white Americans in the North would actually, once be shamed and realize that they were failing in achieving this vision and that they ought to do something. That was his whole pitch, his optimism that people would do the right thing. And that optimism was severely tested because he lived through not just the Civil War, where he met with Abraham Lincoln and influenced Lincoln to take up these ideas in the Gettysburg Address, but also afterwards when Reconstruction failed and the Reign of Terror basically rolled back African-American political emancipation in the South. He saw all this. And in writing and fighting against it all, he wrote down some of the most, the very best distillations and declarations of what the United States is supposed to be about from somebody very clear-eyed, seeing it and having experienced the warts and all, which is why he's such a pivotal figure in the story.
There's also the wonderful story, which I don't think has been very widely disseminated, about South Carolina after the Civil War, the advent of Robert Smalls and of black politicians making decisions for the state and developing for a moment a very radical, progressive, liberal culture within that state, which is ironic given that South Carolina has a reputation for being a particularly racially divided state.
Because, African Americans were a majority of the population in South Carolina, which mm-hmm. was the slave plantation society, the par excellence, the very first one. And so under the force of Union arms and the Union occupation army, with people of African descent able to participate equally in politics, that meant that they had a numerical advantage, more so than any of the other Confederate states, and were able to have a majority within the Constitutional Convention that rewrote the Confederate state constitution of South Carolina, and also were majorities in the legislature that met during the Reconstruction period. And they did indeed. They basically boosted funding for public schools. They eliminated property requirements to vote, which had been very stringent in South Carolina before, and a whole mess of other public investment measures that would, fit very much in with, the Eisenhower, Kennedy, and LBJ administrations much later. And it was, snuffed out through incredible violence and, pogroms and mass murder by the Klan and other sort of terrorist forces that were wanted to roll back and assure that African Americans did not participate in politics, didn't run for office or stand for office or go to the U.S. Senate and Congress as they had, but in fact would be terrorized or through property and literacy requirements somehow effectively stopped from voting at all. And that's where the whole Jim Crow system would come from.
And, you know, at the risk of repeating myself, it seems to me that while that may have been cloaked in some sort of idealistic or albeit rather abhorrent philosophy of the superiority of white Anglo-Saxons over people of basically anybody else from around the globe, was essentially an economic argument. Their fear was that they wouldn't be able to maintain the economy that they created on the backs of the people who were now in the majority.
I mean, perhaps. I mean, certainly their pocketbooks were invested in this, and they didn't want their slave system to fall apart for that reason, and they fought to create a, in effect, indentured or enslaved labor supply through the passing of the so-called Black Codes after the Civil War, which, you know, made the African Americans essentially, you know, practically enslaving them in labor policy without the formal institution existing. So, yeah, the economic impulse and interest was certainly there and served by these policies. I'm not sure if in their heart of hearts that was the only or even the primary way they were thinking, because the idea of, you know, your self-definition of society and, you know, it's, in the end, it's beyond economics. It's about power and about self-definition, you know, of who we think of ourselves as being and how the world ought to be structured. You know, these economics are part of that, but it goes beyond economics into actual ideas about identity and belonging and how things ought to be. So, yes, I don't disagree that economics play a role, but as that being the most important thing of all, I think it's one sinew in a more complicated rope.
I still have this feeling that the so-called failure of Reconstruction was actually just a reactionary response to an ideal. That reactionary response was then codified, if you will, ultimately by Woodrow Wilson, who created what we now call, it seems to me, institutional racism. And again, it strikes me as such an irony that it was dismantled, but it was certainly assailed by a president who came from the Deep South in the 1960s.
Speaking of LBJ.
Yeah.
Yeah, and LBJ is from the, you know, as you will, the Appalachian part of Texas, which also has some bearing on all this. You know, his people are sort of upland Southerners, would be in the Tennessee vocabulary. You know, not a region that was built around plantation, you know, slave crops, as the eastern lowlands of Texas were, but rather small, often impoverished, you know, farmers in the hills. So that's an entirely different culture and political milieu. Would LBJ have gone and done that had Kennedy not been his predecessor and he had been vice president to Kennedy and Kennedy was assassinated and it started the ball rolling? You know, who knows? Would Kennedy have been able to succeed the way LBJ did, being from Massachusetts and not having perhaps all of the incredibly the incredible powers of persuasion and mastery within Congress that LBJ had in his long tenure? Who knows? Those are all the mysteries of history. But yes, you know, it's less shocking that somebody from Greater Appalachia would be involved in that than it would have been if the core figure had come out of, you know, Charleston.
Yes, I agree. Now you've said that. At the same time, it still strikes me as a supreme irony. But it is, as you say, in many ways, Lyndon Johnson was the quintessential politician and was a remarkably persuasive man by all accounts. And as you say, while it might have been, interestingly, again, the vision of a person from New England that started it. It was realized by a man from the South, as you suggest, was probably the only way that could ever have happened. It's kind of an interesting quirk of history, isn't it?
in conjunction with all these other social forces that were happening, and none of it could have happened without, you know, the civil rights movement and MLK, which is essentially a Gandhi-like peaceful uprising within the Deep South for emancipation that occurred at the same time that Kennedy had been shot, LBJ was in the presidency, but also the Cold War, even under Eisenhower, who passed some of the early civil rights legislation. He and any other president sitting in the Oval Office during the existential struggle with the Soviet Union was well aware at how massively damaging in that geopolitical struggle the existence of the apartheid regime of the South was, because most of this proxy war with the Soviets was being fought in non-white countries in what was then called the Third World or the Developing World. And those were places where the Soviets could accurately propagandize that, hey, if you went to the United States, there are large areas where you wouldn't be allowed on the beach. You wouldn't be able to use the toilet or check into a hotel. And, you know, ambassadors to these newly independent countries in Africa and the Middle East and elsewhere, that was exactly their experience. They'd leave Washington to go to a beach, and they'd be turned away because they weren't white. They couldn't, on their drives to go to a conference from D.C., they would be denied service at, you know, roadside restaurants. This was a disaster for, you know, a national security threat to the United States as a whole. So all of those things came together simultaneously to create that environment with LBJ there that allowed the sort of resurgence and perhaps, you know, triumph of the civic national tradition again in the 1960s. Still a work in progress, though.
Agreed. In some sense, and it certainly isn't unique to the United States, it would seem to me that it's a conflict between pragmatism and idealism.
Yeah, well, it's always been even within the ideal tradition, there are all kinds of problems with thinking that, you know, the hubris of thinking that God's chosen your country to do this and that and manifestly cross a continent can get you in all kinds of trouble in and of itself, even without a competing tradition. But in its essence, stripped of its, hubris and arrogance, I guess, you know, it's a universal idea that's in theory open to everyone. And the idea that all humans have this innate humanity and have a right to liberty and to try to pursue their lives as happily as possible isn't a bad set of ideals for a society to be structured around. And I think that's why, you know, people get so upset when the United States doesn't achieve its ideals, is because they're really lofty ones, and therefore the failure is all the more upsetting compared to a country that, you know, sets a much lower bar for itself and maybe succeeds in hurtling over it more often.
I have to say that toward the end of your book, reading the account of the evolution or devolution, depending on your point of view, of Woodrow Wilson's government, I found particularly depressing. But then the epilogue, you seem to embrace the notion espoused by Martin Luther King that this country was born of a promise. We are the heirs to that promise, and we will live to see this country realize that promise.
We're in a perilous spot for sure, but, you know, I do think if I had to wager on our future that, you know, the good side of our past and our traditions, I think, are well in the majority in this country, and that will prevail ultimately. It's not guaranteed, though, to be complacent about it. To be a George Bancroft in these circumstances would be disastrous, because history is tragic and terrible things do happen. But I think that civic tradition, most people really believe that when they think about it. The other tradition, most people, when they think about it, find reprehensible when they really put their mind to it. Not all. I mean, there's a significant group who probably don't, but I think that they're outnumbered, and ultimately that's hard to frustrate, in our system where consensual self-government is still in play.
The book by Colin Woodard is called Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. This is Talking Writing on Scenic Routes.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Routes. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis. Email us at scenicroutes423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroutes423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.